Please welcome Katie Fallon.
Thank you very much, Mark. That was a wonderful introduction. I'm a little nervous. It's great to be here. Thank you very much, everybody, for coming. There are lots of you. I'm very glad to see that. And again, thank you very, very much, Mark, for organizing this and for asking me to read. And also thank you to all those people Mark thanked. That was a very good list. So as Mark mentioned, I really like birds. So you all like birds, right? Just say yes, Katie. Okay. And if you notice, this picture of me on your little yellow thing, it's not actually of me. It's of a black-crowned night heron that's on the rocks by the water's edge, but you can't really, he might have gotten cropped out, but Jesse was actually taking a picture of the night heron, and I just happened to be sitting in the foreground. Oh, well. So before I go ahead and start reading my piece here, I just want to plug two things. One of them, there's a new online literary journal called ConnotationPress.com that many of you are in. And if you're not in it, you know people who are. So you should check it out. I'm the creative nonfiction editor, so you should send me your stuff. Okay, I guess that's the only plug, actually. I lied. Oh, nervous. Bear with me here. The essay that I'm going to read was published in a journal called The Fourth River, and I brought the copy. It's in to show you. And if you recognize this thing on the front, that's the Incline in Pittsburgh. And The Fourth River is published by Chatham University's MFA program. And the journal focuses on all writing that has something to do with environments or nature, travel, place, which is pretty much the stuff I write. So if you write stuff like that too, you should send it to them. And also in this issue is an essay by another one of our graduates, Jillian Shednick. So you should send them your stuff. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and read this piece. And it's funny that Mark mentioned me having birds on my arms. I did almost bring one, but I think the mountain lair has a rule about service animals. But the bird could kind of be a service animal in service of my reading, you know. This piece I'm going to read, it takes place here, and it actually is a situation that occurred before we moved away 5 or 6 years ago. And it was one of those situations, while it was happening, I thought, oh, I should write about this someday. And then I kind of made notes about it and put them away. And then I went back and wrote an essay later that was bad, so I put it away. And then I went back and revised it and eventually sent it to the Fourth River, and they published it, and they nominated it for a Pushcart Prize. Which I was very, very happy about. Didn't win, whatever. Still happy that they nominated it. It makes me think someone might like my writing besides my mom. So this is the one I'm going to read. And it's called Lost. A week after she escaped, we organized a search and rescue style sweep of the forest. Volunteers met at the center in late morning. The sun blazed above us in the sky, melting most of the snow and daring underground bulbs to stir. We formed a horizontal line, about 10 of us, and stood 50 feet apart from each other. Our plan was to keep the line as we walked, eyes scanning the ground. We'd also search the bare tree branches for movement, a flash of a white throat patch, anything. A collapsed cardboard box stuck out the top of a backpack slung over my shoulders. The pack also held heavy welding gloves, a large towel, flashlights, and a cell phone, everything I would need if I found her first. We began moving slowly, heads bent to the forest floor. The ground, thawing and muddy in spots, was covered in soggy leaves. I climbed the gentle slope of a hill and then descended, startling 3 deer. Their white tails bounced away and disappeared. A red-bellied woodpecker scolded from somewhere above me. I stopped and squinted at empty oak branches and prayed for a flutter of owl wing, but there was nothing. Bubo, a great horned owl, had lived in captivity almost her entire life. Her name came from the scientific taxonomy for great horned owls, Bubo virginianus. Dropped off at the West Virginia Raptor Rehabilitation Center, still covered in fluffy down feathers, she had either fallen or been pushed from her nest. The latter is not unusual. Great horned owl parents sometimes resort to infanticide when prey is scarce or if a chick is weak. We raised Bubo and freed her twice, but both times we found her a few days later, hungry, on the ground near the center. We surmise that maybe brain damage, either inherent or trauma-induced, kept her from hunting. Or maybe, despite our best efforts, we couldn't teach her what she needed to know about being wild. We decided that two failed releases were enough, and that her best chance for survival was to remain in captivity. Our veterinarian agreed, so we trained Bubo, and for the last 3 years, she had been the star of hundreds of environmental education programs throughout West Virginia. But now, Bubo was lost. Last weekend, my husband Jesse and I had been 3 hours from home when my cell phone rang. "I don't know how to tell you this," Jeannie, a Raptor Center volunteer, had said, "but Bubo got away from Jenny and me." Okay, wait, I gotta pause. Some of you know Jeannie and Jenny. They both are graduates of the English department. Okay, now I'll continue. "But Bubo got away from Jenny and me. They had shut Bubo in her small travel cage but had not locked the door properly. When Jenny lifted the cage over the electric perimeter fence, Bubo jumped against the door and popped it open. She sailed out, up over the center's shingle roof and into a tall poplar where she was mobbed by crows. After a few moments, she soared downhill, deeper into the woods. Jenny and Jeannie chased her through knee-deep snowdrifts and thick brush, over fallen trunks, twisting their ankles, before the owl got too far ahead of them. "I'm so sorry," Jeannie had said. "I don't know what else to do. She's going to die." I thought that Jeannie was right. Bubo would die. She would not hunt. I would not wish slow starvation on anyone, and even though I hadn't been there at the time of the escape, I felt responsible. Jesse and I were the center's co-education directors, entrusted with the lives and well-being of the non-releasable birds in the center's permanent care. Bubo depended on us for survival, and we had failed her. I imagine Bubo lost in the forest, her heart shivering beneath her feathers. She might stand statue still against an oak trunk, too frightened to move and too disoriented to know which direction to fly. Vaguely familiar sounds swirl around her, but she can't be sure which are prey, which mean danger. Her empty stomach pinches and the branch wobbles beneath her talons. When will someone help? I have never been lost like Bubo. I've been backpacking plenty of times, but I follow trails, carry a topographical map in a waterproof sheath, snap a compass to my belt. I've occasionally gotten lost driving in strange towns, but I always find road signs or service stations. Actual physical lostness must be unnerving, potentially deadly. It's true, of course, that Bubo originated in a forest like this one, hatched in a stick nest meticulously woven by her parents, and thrived under their care for at least a few days. But she didn't survive out here. She wouldn't now. Thinking of Bubo, disoriented, hungry, and perhaps injured, made my stomach tighten. It's difficult for me to define the relationship I have with this bird, but she is more than just a responsibility, more than merely a disabled animal to pity. She is a teacher and a friend. When she wraps her talons around my fist and leans her body against my chest to use me as a shield from a potential threat, I feel like I'm a bridge between a wild world and my own. Although finding Bubo seemed impossible, worse than a needle in a haystack, I had to try. I began walking again, a bit faster than before, with my head down, scanning the ground around my boots. I heard Jesse somewhere to my right call, "Bubo, up." I spun toward his voice, but then he called again and a third time, and I realized that he must have hoped her training command would make her stir, maybe just enough for someone to see movement. When I didn't hear him anymore, I looked around me and noticed I was alone. Jeannie had been 50 feet to my left, but I couldn't see her. Jenny, who had been to my right, was also gone. Had I walked too fast or too slow? I crouched to inspect the forest floor. A flash of red caught my eye on the ground next to my boot. I leaned toward it. It was the wing of a cardinal, just the wing, brilliant red on the primary flight feathers and rustier red on the secondary. At the shoulder was a twisted nub, brownish with dried blood and bone. I picked it up, turning the wing over in my hands, and ran my finger down the longest feather. I imagined this cardinal darting between trees, hauling seeds with his orange beak, chasing other birds, bobbing his red tail. Until the wind is knocked out, the paralyzing shock of a Cooper's hawk, the last painful moments of his life. A Cooper's hawk, or could it have been Bubo? I considered taking the wing, showing it off, reliving the possible circumstances of the cardinal's death. But I suddenly had the feeling I was being watched and scanned the silent trees. I set the wing back on the leaves where it belonged and got to my feet. The cardinal had died wild, doing some task that wild cardinals do. Is Bubo wild? Maybe we were wrong, and she should die here, in the wild, trying to scratch out a life for herself. Die here on the leaves and sink back to the earth. When does an animal stop being wild and become tame, or domestic. Bubo's situation made me question these categories. If ferocity is a mark of wildness, then great horned owls are the wildest birds in the Western Hemisphere, and perhaps the most perfectly evolved avian hunters in the world. They thrive in almost any environment, from Western Alaska to Argentina, and kill and eat a variety of animals, including skunks, squirrels, snakes, ducks, even full-grown turkeys. Fledgling great horned owls at the Raptor Center are among the most aggressive patients we treat. They hiss and strike our hands when we feed them. Despite knowing a few commands and being somewhat accustomed to people, Bubo often behaved like a wild owl. She hissed when disturbed, had strong, deadly talons and a razor beak that she used to swallow dead mice in one gulp. She was 4 pounds of muscle, bone, and silent feathers. Her back, barred with black and brown, was flecked with white like the moon on dark leaves. Bubo's black-ringed yellow eyes shined from crescents of rusty feathers. Sloping black lines above them gave the impression of angry eyebrows. When she spread her wings wide, they measured 5 feet from tip to tip. Of the Raptor Center's non-releasable birds, Bubo intimidated volunteers the most. Only a few of us were comfortable handling her. She had a habit of snapping at our fingers when we fastened the leather leash straps around her feathered legs. Her bites rarely broke the skin, but her aggressive lunges discouraged volunteers. Sometimes she then pulled the leash straps off on the way to educational programs. She actually ate a pair once and had torn several more. But despite her sometimes disagreeable behavior, Bubo could be charming. We knew each other well. By spending time with her, I learned to read her posture, her sounds, the placement of her feather horns, things. When she was in a good mood, I could get her to hoot back to me. She sometimes let Jessie scratch her head when she was tired and would twitter softly, closing her eyes like a sleepy cat. Bubo courted us in breeding season, hooting while puffing her bright white throat patch, tail sticking straight up, inviting us to be her mates. "What a confused bird," Jessie always said. In some ways, I envied Bubo. She shook us off, soared away, and never looked back. She now had another chance to be free, to live the life she began in that stick nest 3 years ago. I wanted her to be free, to feel the wind under her wings, to learn to hunt. But a selfish part of me wanted her home where I could feed her, hold her, sit with her in her flight cage. I can't shrug off this life and make a new one just beyond the tree line. But I know better. Neither can Bubo. She had 2 chances already. Why would this third time be any different? Soon I reached the cleared power line cut, our designated meeting spot, and sat down on the yellow grass. The snow was almost gone, melted except for a few stubborn drifts. A turkey vulture rocked down the hill toward me, floating on the updrafts. He circled once, made sure I wasn't dead, and swept away. On the other side of the hill churned the Monongahela. Acidic from coal mine drainage and choked with mercury, it flows north to Pittsburgh, joins forces with the Allegheny to form the Ohio, and then dumps into the Mississippi. Did Bubo get as far as the river? What if she grew tired and dropped into its brown water, became a wet, struggling thing, and then drowned, swept north, then south again, all the way to the Delta? I watched the tree line. Where were the other volunteers? Where was Bubo? By not finding her, I had failed her again. My cell phone vibrated. Jeannie had reached the power line cut and was walking back toward me. She found a dead turkey, but no Bubo. Jenny came down the hill from the other side, a small black owl pellet in her fist. Could it be from Bubo? Was she hunting? Jessie arrived next, jacket tied around his waist, forearm scratched and bleeding. He had passed a bloated deer carcass lying on its side with its flanks picked apart. Was Bubo eating carrion? We limped back through the woods together to the Raptor Center. By sunset, the other volunteers had gone home, but Jessie and I stayed for one final recovery attempt. I hitched the backpack over my shoulders again and climbed the wooded hill above the center toward the hayfield, an area outside the range of our original sweep. The skeletal oak and poplar trees around me looked black against the setting sun. Below me, a great horned owl's recorded hoot reverberated through the hollow. My boots crunched the now frozen mud of the steep path. I reached the top of the hill and stopped at the tree line, my breath fogging the chilly air. The hayfield in front of me looked desolate. In spring and summer, when high alfalfa stalks sway in the warm breeze, red-winged blackbirds spar above the field and bluebirds flit from hayroll to hayroll. Doe will hide their fawns deep in the tall grass. Now the field seemed depressed and bitter. I decided to skirt its edge. The recording Jessie played below was a male great horned owl. We hoped to manipulate Bubo's breeding cycle or sense of territoriality or both. Now the plan was to listen for Bubo's answering hoots, locate their origin, and somehow get her. During the first week that she had been missing, we sat for 2 hours every morning before sunrise and another 2 hours after sunset playing that hoot, but we never heard a response. At the very least, we prayed the hoots might lure Bubo back to the Raptor Center where we'd been leaving dead rats on the roof. So far, none of the rats had been touched. I labored over a frozen snowdrift, walking on top of its crusty surface before my boot broke through and I sunk to my shin. Early March is an unpredictable time in West Virginia. We could have snow for another month or daffodils in a week. For Bubo's sake, I hoped for the latter. The pink in the sky had faded to icy blue. A sliver of moon curved above the treetops. The hayfield stretched to my left, woods on the right. I passed the remains of a fallen barbed wire fence that goes unnoticed 9 months a year when it's tangled with greenbriars and poison ivy. A hack box, the surrogate nest used for fledging orphan raptors, hung high in a maple on the field's edge. 3 years ago, Bubo was in that box, had twice flown away from it, only to return to us both times. My pulse thudded in my ears. I stopped and listened hard. The CD skipped, chopping the hoot. The speaker crackled. It had been a long day. Defeated and exhausted, I turned and started back. Gradually, we gave up altogether. Our twice-a-day ritual of playing the hoot became once a day, then we quit. And after 2 weeks, we stopped leaving out dead rats. It made me feel sick, like being punched in the stomach, or like seeing an animal recently hit by a car. But more than that, it felt like losing a friend in a crowd, like getting separated on a busy sidewalk and then not being able to find each other again, ever. What else could we do? Bubo was certainly dead, had starved, was now just a clump of soft feathers bunched below a red oak. 5 weeks later, daffodils finally pushed through the brown leaves along the center's gravel driveway. A Phoebe's call buzzed through the hollow. On a counter inside the Raptor Center, a volunteer's note appeared. I think I saw a Bubo in a tree near her flight cage. Jesse and I shrugged and doubted the sighting, having already given up any hope that she was still alive. The following Saturday, we returned this to the center from an educational program. Jesse secured the birds in their cages, and we prepared to leave. It was warm for the second week of April. A few days earlier, a volunteer had tied open the center's loft door to cool it down inside. We were just about to step over the threshold when we heard a wing flap against rafters above us. "Did you put a bird in the loft?" I asked Jesse. We looked at each other. Then he turned and pounded up the wooden stairs. I heard him say, "Bubo, Bubo, up." I waited below, not breathing. Even the dust particles that had been swirling in the sunbeam seemed to freeze. The loft's floorboards creaked above my head. Slowly, Jesse came back down the stairs with an almost starved great horned owl perching weakly on his fist, leaning into his chest. We took her inside the center's ICU. She weighed less than half what she did before she escaped, now just 2 pounds, but her yellow eyes were clear, and she was not injured. She let me scratch her head. I begged her to forgive me. Bubo hasn't told me where she's been, what being wild was like, but I wonder, was she scared? Did she meet other wild things? How far did she go? Did she cross the river? Volunteers joked about her limping home, hungry and maybe knocked up, like a runaway teenager. They laughed and called her a stupid bird. Why would she come back to a cage after more than a month? The most plausible answer, of course, is that routine brought her back, routine and hunger. She spent her entire life with us. The Raptor Center must feel like home, more like home than the wild hardwood forest beyond her cage. She knew that food came from the center. And when she was hungry to the point of starvation, she finally returned to the one place she could count on for a meal. But I would rather imagine a more romantic reason. Bubo returned because she missed her friends. She missed our evening talks, missed getting her head scratched. Maybe she returned because of her sense of responsibility to the children at educational programs, and she missed teaching them. Whatever the reason, after all our efforts, using the combined intellect of a handful of professionals with master's and doctorate degrees, Bubo, the confused owl, came back on her own terms. Kept in, she broke free. Kept out, she worked her way back. How do we classify Bubo? Do wild animals return to captivity on their own? To Bubo, maybe we're all wild or all domesticated, all the same since we share the same space, live together and interact with each other in the same wilderness. This experience has humbled me, has shown me how much I don't know. I will never fully understand Bubo, why she came to the Raptor Center in the first place, or why she returned to us 3 times. I wonder where true intelligence exists in the world. Is it with us, inside our electric fences and logical schemes, or is it in something else, something honest and intangible which resists definition? Within a month of her return, Bubo regained almost all the weight she had lost. Within 3 months, she began participating in educational programs again. We tell audiences that she was released 3 times, twice as a juvenile and once as an adult. Of course, we leave out that the 3rd time she released herself. Now, on clear moonlit nights, Bubo clutches the outside perch in her flight cage and hoots into the forest, She waits, listens, then sometimes grows agitated and flaps hard against the mesh roof of her cage. Then she clings to it and hangs upside down by her talons. What does she listen for out in those woods? Does she have unfinished business? Did she make friends or enemies? I feel empathy for her, confined like this, but I'm also still envious. She was free for a while, and although she might have been lost, still more free than I will ever be. I'm sorry, I tell her. Sorry for letting her escape, for not being able to find her, for keeping her in a cage. I'm sorry she can't claim the life she was born to live. And, in a way, sorry that she didn't die wild. After her flurries of anger, Bubo usually lets herself fall to the grass of her flight cage, hops a few feet, and in two long flaps is back on her perch. There she sits, watching, listening, waiting. Maybe if I'm quiet enough and patient, someday I'll be able to hear it too. Thank you.